since this crisis emerged?
There has been none. I mean, there is no direct relationship. Nobody's offered us anything.
Have you asked for federal relief?
Sure. Sure. We wrote the letter. We wrote a letter to the White House a year and a half ago, asking for assistance and help in infrastructure, which is what we're doing now.
A lot of money going to build a wall on the border. Right. Your thoughts?
Well, we should be using that for infrastructure, particularly around this water issue. I mean, this is hundreds of millions of dollars, billions across the country. I mean, Newark is not there are 70 cities in the state of New Jersey that are affected by this, in all 21 counties.
New Jersey governors mentioned supporting a millionaire's tax. Do you think this should be used to address infrastructure? Do you support this?
I absolutely support the millionaire's tax. It should be used to address a whole bunch of things, but this is one of them.
You're
yes.
holding a State of the Water Town Hall on Wednesday. Where is it being held, and what do you expect to come from that?
At the New Jersey Performing Arts Center, I think that, we want to do this, want to update everybody on where we are, and to do talk about some of the things that people have on their mind, really address some of these things that I think have been unfair or just straight out not true. I think there's a lot of misinformation out on the street, and we just need to address it. And the more town halls we've done a series of them. We've been doing them for at least 2 years now on this issue. The more contact we come in with people, the clearer they become, and they leave with a different sense of what's happening in their mind.
Well, Raz Baraka, we want to thank you for being with us. Mayor of Newark, New Jersey, elected May 2014. Juan Gonzalez will be speaking this Thursday, October 3rd, at the 60th anniversary of Claridad in San Juan, Puerto Rico. For details, visit our website at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Behind the Bullet film screening on Friday, October 4th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Multnomah Arts Center in Portland. The documentary film Behind the Bullet deepens awareness of untold stories from the U.S. gunfire epidemic. Director Heidi Heumann will be in attendance and answer questions after the film. There will then be a soul box procession into Multnomah Village. Again, that's Behind the Bullet film screening on Friday, October 4th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Multnomah Arts Center, 7688 Southwest Capitol Highway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of In the Blink of an Eye, our opening featuring a talk by Barbara Bernstein on Thursday, October 3rd from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Clackamas Community College campus in Wilsonville. In the Blink of an Eye is a multi-layered art exhibit which delves into the history, science, and technology behind atomic weapons and power. Barbara Bernstein will be speaking at 4:30 p.m. about the Hanford nuclear site, followed by brief artist talks. Again, that's In the Blink of an Eye, art opening featuring a talk by Barbara Bernstein on Thursday, October 3rd from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Clackamas Community College campus, 29353 Southwest Town Center Loop East in Wilsonville. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Nuclear war?
Yeah.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the woman who murdered Botham Jean in his own apartment has been found guilty.
The Trailblazers have ended their partnership with a local weapons manufacturer.
And in international news, a teenage protester was shot by police during the ongoing clashes in Hong Kong.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 1st, 2019. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu.
And I'm Leslie McLam. The woman who murdered 26-year-old Botham Jean in his own apartment in 2018 has been found guilty. Former Dallas police officer Amber R. Geiger fatally shot her unarmed black neighbor in September of last year. Geiger said she accidentally went to the wrong floor of their apartment complex, entered the unit directly above hers, and fatally shot him. Geiger claimed she thought she was entering her own apartment and was acting in self-defense against an apparent intruder. Geiger was found guilty of murder and faces a prison sentence of between 5 and 99 years. The length of punishment will be decided by the jury, who began hearing testimony for sentencing this afternoon. Jean's mother testifies that she often has been sick and unable to work since the loss of her son, whose birthday fell during the trial. He would have been 28. The shooting ignited protests and calls for justice, with demonstrations occurring at the Dallas Police Headquarters and City Hall. Protesters were outraged that Geiger was not immediately arrested at the scene and only charged with manslaughter several days later. After weeks of tension, the grand jury came back with a guilty verdict for the charge of murder. At a time when other police officers have often been cleared of wrongdoing in the deaths of unarmed black men, the guilty verdict led to an eruption of cheers in the courtroom.
A teenage protester in Hong Kong was shot as unrest in the Chinese-ruled city continues to grow. This is the first person to be hit by live ammunition in almost 4 months. Clashes between citizens and police spread from the shopping district of Causeway Bay to the Admiralty area of government offices on Hong Kong Island and onto the new territories bordering mainland China. Police fired tear gas and water cannons at the protesters. According to law enforcement, one officer shot an 18-year-old man in the shoulder with a live round. Protesters have previously been hit with beanbag rounds and rubber bullets, while officers have fired live rounds into the air. The police chief, Stephen Low, said the firing of live rounds was lawful and fair, adding, quote, "Police lives were under serious threat. That's why they fired live rounds." Dramatic video footage captured the incident. It shows riot police battling protesters wielding metal bars before an officer fires a shot at close range. As the wounded teenager steps back and falls, another protester tries to help, but police tackle him to the ground. The wounded teenager underwent emergency surgery, and health officials say his condition is still critical. Tuesday's clashes are the most widespread since the unrest in Hong Kong began in early June. The protests were initially triggered by a controversial extradition bill, which has since been withdrawn. However, the movement has now evolved into a much wider campaign.
An audit of the Portland Police Department has found that an over-reliance on overtime has worn out police officers. According to the report from the Portland City Auditor, officers cumulatively worked more than 240,000 extra hours in 2018, more than double a regular work week. In response to the audit, Police Chief Daniel Outlaw called the Bureau's reliance on overtime a significant issue that they were well aware of, rooted in a severe staffing shortage. However, the audit called this reasoning faulty and instead points the finger at poor management of the department. The report says commanders in charge of the precincts, who are supposed to monitor the reports to gauge overtime trends, are not being given any reports. Auditors also partially blamed a faulty timekeeping system that did not reflect an officer's shift assignments or who authorized the overtime. The audit suggests putting a hard limit on how much overtime officers can work, similar to police forces in Denver and San Francisco. Continuing to heavily rely on overtime could leave the police department susceptible to widespread burnout and on-the-job injuries.
The news staff at the Columbia newspaper have announced their intent to unionize. They said their intention is to form a union that will bargain collectively for wages, benefits, and working conditions. The Columbian Guild would represent reporters, photographers, copy editors, page designers, and newsroom assistants as part of the Pacific Northwest Newspaper Guild, Local 37082. In a mission statement released on Monday, the group said, quote, "Our journalists are overworked and underpaid. We must make choices between doing the work we love and buying homes, starting families, and putting down roots in this community. This doesn't serve our company, and it doesn't serve our readers." According to Brad Sherman, the administrative officer for the Pacific Northwest Newspaper Guild in Seattle, representatives notified publisher Scott Campbell of their intent to unionize on Monday and asked him to voluntarily recognize the bargaining unit. However, Campbell declined, saying he was disappointed in the action and does not see a benefit of unionization to employees. Sherman said the next step will likely be filing with the National Labor Relations Board, requesting that it conduct an election on unionization. The vote would take place in about 4 weeks, unless Campbell opts to recognize the union in the interim. In a release statement, the staff said, quote, "We call on the Columbian to meet us at the bargaining table to set policies that promote job security, pay that reflects the cost of living, and staffing that allows us to tell the stories of our community. We intend to bargain for equitable wages, greater diversity in the workplace, reasonable leave and health benefits, earned severance, and a fair and consistent grievance policy."
The Oregon Department of Transportation is facing some pushback today as comments made on the personal Twitter account of one of their staffers appear to mock concerns about safety. Tiana Tozer is the Region of Transportation Safety Coordinator for the ODOT, and she sits on the Portland Vision Zero Task Force, dedicated to eliminating deaths and serious injuries from traffic. After a PBOT event Thursday morning, where Tozer held signs with community members asking cars to slow down, the effectiveness of this tactic was questioned on Twitter. Tozer responded with, quote, "Ho hum, another entitled American sitting back and watching people die, but he himself has no solution. How easy it is to criticize. God forbid you should be a part of the solution. Don't strain yourself." That was just the start. Tozer went on to post 47 more tweets in the thread, including one that read, quote, "No matter how much we engineer our streets, some idiot like you will still find a way to die on them." The comments were made on Tozer's personal Twitter account, but her status as a state employee and member of high-profile Committee on Traffic Safety bring them under even greater scrutiny. 14 people have died while walking Portland streets so far this year.
The Portland Trailblazers have ended their partnership with a Beaverton-based manufacturer of rifle scopes. The company, Leupold & Stevens, manufactures rifle scopes and sells them to the United States military and other armed forces, including the Israeli Defense Force. According to the Oregonian, the company is the world's largest rifle scope manufacturer in terms of sales. The Israeli Defense Force signed a contract worth about $2.72 million with Leupold & Stevens in 2017, which provided their armed forces with 800 scopes. A group of local organizations, including the Portland Democratic Socialists of America, Jewish Voice for Peace, Veterans for Peace, and the Poor People's Campaign, sent a letter to the Blazers in August, asking the team to end its partnership with the company. The letter read in part, quote, "Portland claims to be a progressive city that cares about the rights of all people, and the Trailblazers represent our city to the nation. Your partnership with weapons manufacturer Leupold & Stevens directly contradicts the mission by disregarding the suffering of children and families across the globe and enabling a company that may be complicit in crimes against humanity to present a positive public image." During Monday's media day, the Trailblazers president and CEO, Chris McGowan, was asked about the team's partnership with Leupold & Stevens. McGowan answered, quote, "Leupold is no longer a partner of the organization. For various reasons, some unrelated to what you're referencing, they've decided to go in a different direction, so they're no longer a partner of our team." According to McGowan, the protests over the past year were not responsible for the dissolution of the partnership.
And now it's time for Labor History in 2 from host Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1851. That was the day that William Henry, a black cooper or barrel maker who went by the name of Jerry, was arrested in Syracuse, New York. He was first told that he was being arrested for theft, but then he learned that federal marshals had arrested him for violating the Fugitive Slave Act passed the year before. Jerry had escaped slavery in Missouri. The Anti-Slavery Liberty Party was holding its convention in a nearby church. When word came about Jerry's arrest, a crowd rushed to release him. Once released, he was quickly recaptured and returned to custody. But then a large crowd, numbering more than 2,000, gathered to free Jerry from the office where he was being held. According to research done by the Syracuse University Library, the first person into the office was J.M. Clapp, an iron worker likely chosen for his brawn. The crowd was able to free Jerry and hide him until he could escape into Canada. Clapp also had to flee to Canada to avoid arrest along with eight others. 19 people were indicted for participating in the rescue. Only one person was ever convicted, and he died before he could appeal. In turn, the abolitionists won an indictment against the marshal who had arrested Jerry. They charged him with kidnapping. Although the marshal was acquitted, it gave the abolitionists a chance to publicly challenge the constitutionality of the Fugitive Slave Act. Each year until 1858, a Jerry Rescue celebration commemorated the event. Abolitionists referred to the, quote, Jerry level as a standard for justice. In 2001, a monument to the rescue was dedicated in Clinton Square in downtown Syracuse. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
The man who was accused of throwing roofing nails onto roads across Portland over the past 2 years has been arrested. Oregon City Police arrested 56-year-old Brett Michael Wilson after he was seen throwing nails onto South Center Street in Oregon City. Wilson told police he has thrown nails onto streets over 50 times in the past couple years, not just in Oregon City, but across the Portland metro area. The nails have damaged the tires of some commuters, although no one has been injured. Wilson is being held at the Clackamas County Jail and faces 4 counts of second-degree disorderly conduct.
Multnomah County officials are asking residents to check the air quality before burning wood in their fireplaces. The county's seasonal wood smoke restrictions take effect today. The regulations restrict homes and businesses from burning wood on the worst air quality days of the year for the next 6 months. Wood stoves and fireplaces release tiny toxic particles, and on days where air pollution levels are already high, wood smoke pollutants can significantly worsen air quality. This can be detrimental for children, seniors, and those with compromised immune systems or breathing conditions. The ordinance bans the use of wood stoves, fireplaces, outdoor fire pits, and freestanding chimneys on poor air quality days. The rule makes exceptions for low-income households who rely solely on wood as their heating method. On days where forecasters predict the air quality could become dangerous, a 24-hour ban will be announced by 11 a.m. to go into effect at noon. Last year, the county had only 2 no-burn days.
The Latino Victory Foundation lifted voices at the Iowa Latino Heritage Festival soapbox over the weekend, where Congressman Joaquin Castro campaigned for his brother. Lily Bulkey has more on this story with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa.
To come here and see the growing Latino community in Des Moines and in Iowa, it's fantastic to see. You have Mexican Americans, Puerto Ricans, Salvadorans. So it's exciting to see the community growing here and the folks that are powering different industries in Iowa more and more. So it's been great. You know, we've had some wonderful conversations.
That was Texas Representative Joaquin Castro, Democratic hopeful Julian Castro's twin brother. He campaigned for his brother at the Iowa Latino Heritage Festival soapbox over the weekend. The soapbox was co-sponsored by D.C.-based Latino Victory Foundation, part of a progressive collection of organizations co-founded by actress Eva Longoria. Here's Executive Director Myra Macias.
Why we're so interested in partnering up with the soapbox is that we want to make sure that we're helping uplift local Latino organizations that are doing, you know, the hard work of educating and mobilizing the Latino community so that they're actively engaged.
Castro was not the only speaker at the soapbox. Hawaii Representative Tulsi Gabbard and former Pennsylvania Representative Joe Sestak spoke, as well as many Latino senior staff members of other candidates' campaigns.
It was just so powerful to hear from so many diverse Latino voices because, you know, Latino community is not a monolith. And it was just so inspiring to see the various paths that people took to get the positions where they are. And despite, you know, whomever they're supporting or whomever they're campaigning for, to know that these folks are centering the Latino community in their work.
Some local Republican politicians did attend the soapbox and speak. All of the Republican presidential candidates were invited, but none participated, including President Donald Trump, who's embroiled in the whistleblower scandal. This upcoming election cycle, the Latino community is on track to be the largest non-white ethnic voting bloc, with 32 million eligible voters, just over 13% of the voter population. According to a report from Pew Research Center, an increase in Hispanic and Asian populations since 2000 makes about a third of projected 2020 eligible voters non-white. Here's Marcias again.
That folks who may not be civically engaged, you know, see themselves represented or see folks that look like them advocating and centering our communities is just so powerful, and it's going to be so critical to making sure that we realize our political potential.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Australia's prime minister enters the fray about Trump's efforts to dig up dirt on Biden. And could immigrants fill the U.S. healthcare workforce gap? Mike Clifford has more on these stories.
The Public News Service DOA newscast for Tuesday, October the 1st, 2019. I'm Mike Clifford. The Australian prime minister gets into the mix on Trump efforts to dig up dirt on Biden. Plus, could immigrants help fill the healthcare workforce gap? Topping our news, President Trump pushed the Australian prime minister during a recent call to help the Attorney General, Bill Barr, gather information for a Justice Department inquiry. The White House curbed access to a transcript of the call, which the president made at Barr's request. The New York Times notes the discussion with Prime Minister Morrison shows the extent to which Mr. Trump views the Attorney General as a critical partner. And immigrants could help Tennessee fill its health care workforce gap. That's according to a new report by the Business Forward Foundation.
Foreign-born individuals currently make up less than 5% of the state's total population. President of the foundation, Jim Doyle, says the number of Tennessee seniors will nearly double by 2070. He points out that without new immigrants, the ongoing doctor shortage and lack of health care access experienced by people living in rural parts of the state will worsen.
And the math suggests that if we cut off immigrants, then Tennessee is one of the states that's going to suffer most.
The report also found that immigrants provide Tennessee around $527 million in economic contributions each year. I'm Nadia Ramlagan.
The report's authors say less restrictive immigration policies could grow Tennessee's GDP by $9.9 billion, and that's just over the next decade. For people from other countries looking for vacation spots, Suzanne Potter reports the U.S. may not be top of mind.
A new report blames President Donald Trump's policies for hurting international tourism to the U.S. The study cites what it calls the Trump slump in California tourism in particular. Jim Doyle heads the Business Forward Foundation, which produced the report. He notes that in the first 6 months of 2019, international tourism worldwide grew at a rate of 3-4%, but in the U.S. it contracted by 1.7%.
Calling Mexicans rapist, a trade war with China has hurt America's market share around the world, millions of jobs and billions of income, and no state's paying more than California.
The report says President Trump's Muslim travel ban, anti-immigrant policies and rhetoric, visa rollbacks, and tariffs on Chinese goods have combined to create a negative impression that drives foreign tourists away. The president has defended his policies, saying they are designed to protect national security and correct trade imbalances.
The report shows the U.S. overall share of international tourism is falling. Had its share remained the same as 2019, this year alone, the nation would have seen an additional 59 billion tourist visits. This is PNS. Domestic Violence Awareness Month begins today. Advocates are gathering in Ohio at the State House there, among other places, to reflect on progress made to help survivors while remembering the lives lost.
The How Domestic Violence Network is honoring Representative Laura Lanise with the Croucher Family Award for Outstanding Leadership for her efforts to include $1 million in the state budget for domestic violence services. Executive Director Mario Doherty says it's the first time such funding has been included in the state's general fund.
Representative Lanise opened a door for us. We will be working with her to increase the state funding that flows to DV services. So it's our opportunity to rally the troops and to thank Representative Lanise, but also to say we've got a lot more work to do.
An annual list of domestic violence fatalities in Ohio also will be released, which shows that in the year ending July 1st, at least 81 lives were lost. 53 of the deceased were victims, including 41 women and 12 men. In 25% of fatalities, a child was present at the scene. Mary Sherman reporting.
The data shows that in 80% of cases where a woman actually killed a man, there was a past history of the woman having been abused by the man. Finally, Eric Gladys reports agriculture is the fourth largest producer of climate pollution, and farmers and ranchers across the U.S. have launched a campaign urging the Congress to pass a Green New Deal. It would support regenerative family farm and ranching practices over industrial agribusiness.
Catherine Paul with the group Regeneration International says farmers across the political spectrum are seeing the proposal as an opportunity to level the playing field.
The goals that are laid out in this Green New Deal are goals that we as farmers can help achieve in this country. We can be the clean water heroes. We can be the climate heroes. We can be the health heroes if we just get the policy and program support.
Paul notes that 85% of the nation's $25 billion farm subsidies go to the biggest 15% of businesses, which rely on factory farming, synthetic fertilizers, chemical pesticides, and other practices linked to increased air and water pollution. Paul says supporting cleaner practices will produce healthier food and enrich soil by capturing more carbon. Critics of the Green New Deal say it's too expensive and argue that a better way to address climate change would be to encourage innovation in the private sector. Paul says the Green New Deal is an opportunity to reinvest money we're already spending in innovative private family-scale farms. But she admits change won't come easy. Agribusiness currently spends more than the defense industry lobbying Congress.
What they want is rarely good for small, independent farmers and ranchers who are interested in farming in a way that benefits everyone.
I'm Mike Clifford for Public News Service. We are member and listener-supported, and we are online at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Jenny Brown, a feminist organizer in the women's liberation movement and an author of several books, including her new work, Without Apology, The Abortion Struggle Now. Then at 6, it's Transpositive PDX. And at 7, Calculated Conversation. Tonight's weather will be clear skies with a low of 42 degrees. Tomorrow will be mostly cloudy with light winds and a high of 63 degrees. Today in history, in 1890, Yosemite National Park is established by an act of Congress. The quote of the day is from Scottish-American naturalist John Muir, who said, quote, "When one tugs at a single thing in nature, he finds it attached to the rest of the world."
Kentucky's rate of child abuse is more than twice the national average, according to the U.S. Department for Health and Human Services. In Kentucky, new trainings aim to educate people on early signs of child abuse. Nadia Ramlagan has the story.
Training sessions on how to recognize early signs of child abuse will be held this week in Louisville and Lexington. The events, run by CoSare Charities' Face It Movement, are designed to educate social workers, early childhood educators, emergency medical service providers, and concerned community members on how to spot red flag bruising on children. Dr. Melissa Curry is a forensic pediatrician leading one of the trainings in Louisville. Curry points out that generally, child abuse occurs as an escalation of violence over time.
What that means for us is that if we can learn to recognize the early warning signs, the more subtle bruising that happens sort of earlier in the process, we can intervene and help protect these children before the abuse escalates to near fatal or fatal injury.
The trainings will be held on Friday and are free and open to the public. For more information, including information on available continuing education credits, visit faceitmovement.org. org. Keith Inman of COSAIR Charities says 6 years ago, his organization decided it was time to begin to publicly address the state's epidemic of child abuse.
Well, in Kentucky, we lead the nation in the incidence of abuse and neglect. So the fact that we're having these trainings and trying to get more people involved and more organizations involved, because at the end of the day, child abuse is an adult issue.
Dr. Curry notes that the 10-4 rule can be used to decide whether or not to be worried about a particular bruise on a child.
So the TEN stands for torso, ears, and neck, and the 4 means any child 4 years of age or younger. And then the second part of that rule is any bruising anywhere on an infant who's not yet pulling up and taking steps.
Research shows that far more children experience maltreatment than statistics convey. Curry says this often occurs because medical or family services providers miss subtle but important indicators early on.
For us to help the public understand what kinds of bruises in children are normal and what kinds aren't normal is probably one of the most powerful things we can do to prevent child maltreatment.
Last year in Jefferson County alone, there were more than 20,000 reports of suspected child abuse and neglect made to the state's Department for Community-Based Services. For Public News Service, I'm Nadia Romlagan.
UPS announced today that it has received government approval to operate a, quote, drone airline. However, this new drone service will not be used to deliver you a package anytime soon. Instead, UPS says they will first use the certification to build a drone delivery network for hospital campuses around the U.S. The Federal Aviation Administration gave the approval, which includes allowing the company to fly as many drones as it wants, carry cargo that weighs more than 55 pounds, fly at night, and will also let its drones fly beyond a pilot's visual line of sight. UPS is the first company to get this type of certification, which is only possible by an exception from the FAA. Other notable companies working on drone delivery include Amazon Air and Uber Eats. UPS Chairman and CEO David Abney said in an interview, quote, "It just gives us a lot of capabilities. We're going to move ahead quickly and expand rapidly. It's not going to be a small operation."
This morning, a federal court affirmed the Federal Communication Commission's repeal of Obama-era net neutrality rules that prohibited internet providers from blocking, slowing down, or speeding up access to websites. It has been legal for internet providers to block access to websites since June of 2018. However, the net neutrality case had many advocates and website owners who rely on open consumer access to the web hopeful it would get repealed. Net neutrality is pretty much dead. Telecom companies like Comcast, Verizon, and AT&T can do whatever they want to their customers' connections and web access as long as they reserve the right to do so in their terms of service. For these companies, the death of net neutrality could mean big profits, where web companies can pay to play in the faster lane. This deregulation threatens the ideal of the open web, where anyone can build a website with an equal base capacity to reach people.
Investing in the local economy can be a way to strengthen local communities and civic life. Nevada is holding a conference which will be the one-stop shop for aspiring artists and food entrepreneurs in rural communities. Eric Galatis has more on this story.
Local foods and the arts are emerging market opportunities for rural communities, and the Center for Rural Affairs is hosting a one-day conference on October 10th in Pender designed to give aspiring entrepreneurs a leg up. Sandra Renner with the center says the event will help connect small food and arts-based businesses with the tools they need to be successful and access to resources usually only found at larger conferences in urban areas.
A lot of the resources just aren't known to aspiring or existing businesses, so we see that need and that gap, and we want to make sure that people can come together under one roof and make it a one-stop shop.
There will be sessions on how to access startup funds, small business basics such as accounting and creating a business plan. There will also be presentations on developing cooperatives and how to start a food hub to make it easy for local businesses to get their locally grown foods at wholesale prices without having to track down individual producers. Participants can also get tips on how to market and sell their artwork and learn more about how local foods and art can bring communities together. Michael Fortunato with Creative Insight Community Development is the conference's keynote speaker. He says at a time of deepening partisan polarization, investing in arts and food entrepreneurship can strengthen local economies and civic life.
Food and art seem to be two things that really bring people together, and it gives everyone a common sense of community and a way to really start conversations that are meaningful at the local level.
An optional post-conference session will be held the same day where people can meet one-on-one with panelists. Pre-conference sessions will also be offered Wednesday, October 9th in Walt Hill and Winnebago. Funding for the conference is provided by a U.S. Department of Agriculture Rural Business Development grant. Registration info is available at cfra.org. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Galatis.
The Blackfoot Nation is digging out of an early season snowstorm, and tribal veteran affairs agencies are teaming up with researchers. With these stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Blackfeet tribe in northwest Montana is just beginning to dig out of a record-breaking early season snowstorm. Aaron Bolton reports it will take a few days for the snow to melt and things to return to normal.
By Saturday morning, 20 inches of snow had already fallen on the Blackfeet Nation. Robert DeRozier with the Blackfeet Tribe's Disaster and Emergency Services activated emergency operations that morning. Reached by phone Monday, DeRozier says most calls for help didn't start to pour in until Sunday.
We responded to calls all day. Since Friday till this morning, we had 43 ambulance calls and multiple calls for service and rescue.
Montana Governor Steve Bullock declared a winter storm emergency Sunday. Jane Fogelman with the National Weather Service in Great Falls says 4 feet of snow was recorded in Browning as of Monday morning. That obliterates the city's 13-inch record for September snowfall from 1934 and also breaks the record for a two-day snow event.
The greatest two-day snowfall total was 36 inches on the 25th of September, 1908.
The National Weather Service was able to accurately forecast the storm well ahead of time, and the Blackfeet Tribe's Robert DeRozier says most heeded the warning. That allowed the tribe to close some roads early and get a Red Cross shelter set up before the weekend. DeRozier says the snow began melting Monday and the tribe is plowing roads.
And so we're just a bunch of busy little ants up here trying to dig out from this storm.
As of Monday afternoon, only two highways remained closed, and road conditions are expected to improve as temperatures warm through the week, but snowmelt could refreeze with below freezing temperatures at night. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
Tribal Veterans Affairs offices in South Dakota are teaming up with a research group to help find the needs of veterans. They hope data gathering will improve funding and services. China Lockett has more.
Reservations are some of the most remote and rural parts of South Dakota. Robert Dunsmore is the Tribal Service Veterans Officer for Cheyenne River. He is one of two Veterans Affairs, or VA, employees serving the reservation. He says his isn't the only tribal VA office that's understaffed and offers limited services.
We don't have the funding to be doing things like we should, like mainstream America. Like when you go to Sioux Falls, Rapid City, you got a vet center, everything else, and them places, we don't have that here.
He says it's important to make services like healthcare, housing, and mental health available to veterans, and location is part of that. Many veterans' only other option is to travel to larger centers, hours away. Dunsmore says when he asks for tribal VA service funding, federal and state entities want to see data to show how many veterans live in the area. However, that data didn't exist before this survey.
The state of South Dakota alone has a little over 72,000 veterans registered in the state. 38,000 of them are American Indian veterans.
The survey his team conducted for the Oglala Lakota, Sisseton Wahpeton, and Cheyenne River tribes are the first to highlight local veterans' populations and their needs. In 3 months, they found the veteran populations on all three tribes. The highest number, 99, in Cheyenne River.
That still don't show our numbers, but it's a start.
Dunsmore says these numbers show there's more than enough people in the area to increase local VA funding and services. He says legislators have told his team to expect changes soon. For National Native News, I'm Chyna Lockett in Rapid City.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Tractor drivers in the Netherlands took to the streets today to demand greater recognition, and they may have caused the worst ever Dutch morning rush hour. According to motoring organization ANWB, there were about 700 miles of traffic jams at the morning peak. Farmers were reacting to a recent report that claimed they were largely responsible for a nitrogen oxide emissions problem. The report called for inefficient cattle farms to be shut down and some speed limits to be lowered to cut pollution. But farming groups believe they are being victimized while the aviation industry is escaping scrutiny. The tractors arrived early Tuesday morning, some even knocking down fences. Thousands of farmers, many on their tractors, took part in the protest in a field in the center of The Hague. According to police, more than 2,000 farmers joined the protest and three people were arrested. As the tractors headed home after the protest, the main infrastructure agency warned of major disruption for the evening rush hour as well.
The EPA has temporarily halted work on a biofuels policy adjustment to help farmers because of the ongoing impeachment probe. This could mean the risk of a proposal not being ready in time to implement next year. The causes of the delay include recent demands by representatives of the oil industry for concessions in the deal to boost biofuel use, as well as the impeachment inquiry launched by Congress against Donald Trump, which has diverted the administration's attention. The deal was intended to assuage anger in the U.S. farm community, a critical constituency for Trump as he seeks re-election. The delay at the EPA has raised concerns that the administration will not be able to alter next year's biofuel volume mandates to help farmers. The deadline to finalize mandates for 2020 is November 30th, giving the EPA just 2 months to draft a plan, release it for public comment, and finalize it.
Climate change could undo progress in education for girls around the world. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In recent decades, the education of girls around the world has increased dramatically. But climate change threatens to reverse some of that progress. Extreme weather can increase poverty and force families to leave their homes. In Bangladesh, for example, coastal flooding has forced many poor, rural people to migrate to Dhaka, a crowded megacity. Sanye Gulsar Korat is director of the Division of Gender Equality at UNESCO, a UN agency. She says when families are forced to migrate, girls often take on additional responsibilities.
They take care of their siblings, they take care of the disabled and the elderly. They are hired out as help to others. So in most cases, even when education possibilities exist, girls are not usually the ones who can take advantage.
She says families struggling to survive may also encourage their teenage daughters to get married.
This is one less mouth to feed,
which tends to cut short their education. So she says climate change could be life-altering for women and girls around the globe. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Many municipalities spray a mixture of wastewater from gas and oil wells on their dirt and gravel roads. With more on this story, it's CurrentCast.
Take me home, country roads. On this CurrentCast. Driving on dirt roads kicks up dust that can make it hard to see and cause respiratory problems for people who live nearby. In some areas, a wastewater mix from oil and gas production is sprayed on dirt and gravel roads to suppress the dust. The wastewater is usually free, but it contains radium, which can leach into groundwater. William Burgess of Penn State University says other options, such as a sodium chloride mix, are available. And researchers are studying alternatives, such as vegetable oils, which would be
greener and easier to biodegrade in the environment.
Pennsylvania stopped using wastewater last year, but it's still common in many other states. CurrentCast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future and made possible by the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. Online at currentcast.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 1st, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. The producer for tonight's newscast is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Ted Jones. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu.
And I'm Leslie McLamb. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland. At 9, that's The Politics of Living. And at 10, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 a.m., The Bike Show brings you news and views of cycling in Oregon and beyond. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support, and if you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We're here today with author and activist Jenny Brown. Jenny is an organizer with the National Women's Liberation and the author of a number of titles, including her most recent book, Without Apology, The Abortion Struggle Now. Jenny, thank you for being here.
It's great to be here.
Let's jump right in. So in your book, Birth Strike, The Hidden Fight Over Women's Work, you conceptualize the struggle over contraception and abortion not as one about religious values, but instead as a struggle over labor. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, I think with abortion, we often think of it as a cultural issue, one that's very based on people's religious beliefs. But the birth rate in the United States is now the lowest it's ever been, and we've started to see signs of the power structure and the establishment really panicking about this. And one of the ways that countries have responded to lower birth rates is by making it easier to have kids, by providing child care and health care and paid leave, like up to a couple of years of paid leave for both parents. But here, what we've seen is more and more restrictions on our reproductive liberties. So instead of providing things that would make it easier to have kids, we are basically getting a coercive response from our government. So I argue that the this is based on basically corporations do not want to spend money on healthcare and childcare and paid leave for their workers. They don't want to pay taxes so we can have a national childcare system like they have in other countries. And basically, they're exploiting our labor and getting it for free. And the response of people has been to have fewer kids.
And so, how does that idea of it being a labor struggle change our understanding of how we have to fight for these reproductive issues and justice?
Well, I think we need to stop arguing the religious angles of it and sort of arguing, you know, when life begins and all of these things, and start really talking about reproductive rights as our right to strike against unfair reproductive working conditions. And I think reproductive justice, which is a term which was coined by Black women in the 90s to describe the whole range of things we need, being able to have kids as well as being able to not have kids and to be able to raise our kids in healthy conditions, really expresses what the reason that we need reproductive rights. We need it in order to be able to determine how we're going to have kids and what our child rearing is going to be like. Right now, we're stressed out. We're overworked. We're exploited. And so people are just deciding to have fewer kids, but that's not really a solution for us. We want to be able to have kids when we want them. We don't want to be restricted. The answer that we've been getting from even establishment Democrats in many cases is, well, if you can't afford kids, you just use birth control. And that's not really an answer for people who want to be able to have children. It's a human right to be able to have children, just as it's a human right to not have them if you don't want them. So I think reproductive justice really expands our view of that. And if we think about it that way, we get a sense of the power that it gives us and the importance of that power to our liberty. And I think it also allows us to get off of the sort of the choice narrative where it's very much sort of a consumer thing, it's a personal decision, and look at the political power that's behind all of these things.
So when it comes to making a choice about whether or not to reproduce, I want to ask about abortion regulation in the U.S. today. What is the current state of abortion law in Oregon, first off?
Well, I'm not from Oregon, but my understanding is that Oregon has one of the closest to what we want, which is we don't want it in the criminal law at all, right? There should reproductive decisions and reproductive outcomes should not be treated in the penal code. It should not be a criminal offense, whatever happens. So that's where we really want to go. And the reason that we have to go there is because we have all these different levels of laws right now, and they're being used against folks who have a reproductive outcome that is not, it's like they have a miscarriage and then they're accused of having giving themselves an abortion. Anytime you have those laws, people are going to start getting arrested for it. It's just
right. So just today, a federal judge temporarily blocked Georgia's restrictive new abortion law from taking effect. The law would ban abortions once a fetal heartbeat is detected, which can happen as early as 6 weeks. That's a month and a half into a pregnancy, before many women are even realizing that they're expecting. And this is after many other state legislations severely restricting abortion laws have been blocked by courts. In other states like Missouri, Mississippi, Kentucky, Ohio, Louisiana, how can activists in progressive states organize in support of those in states with restrictive abortion laws?
I think we need to go for a national solution. I think we need to demand that we have no abortion laws, no criminal penalties throughout the United States. I mean, there are a lot of ways to do that. You could pass a federal law that everybody has the right to do whatever they want. But of course, what we're looking at right now is all of these 6 week bans and the heartbeat things and all of those are going to continue to get struck down by the courts until the Supreme Court reconsiders some of them. And most of these states are trying to be the one to overturn the basis of Roe versus Wade. So they're trying to get the Supreme Court to consider their case. And so these cases are all going to be working their way through the courts. So that's what we're facing. I think we really need to start talking about just the basic necessity of reproductive freedom, and also why is the abortion pill so expensive and so restricted? At-home abortions are perfectly safe now. Why is that not an option for people? And I think we need to start talking about that. And in fact, committing some civil disobedience around availability of the abortion pill. I think that's going to be one of the things that we need to start doing.
And so, speaking of civil disobedience, you were actually on the front lines to open up access to Plan B, or the morning after pill. And so can you tell us a little bit about that and what you kind of learned from that experience?
Yeah, we were struggling to get the morning after pill, which is after sex contraception. It works up to 96 hours after sex. After that, it doesn't really work. And it was prescription only in the United States, even though there were 30 or 40 countries at the time that had it over the counter. The problem with prescription only is it adds costs and time, and a pill that's the more effective the sooner you take it. So we were trying to get it over the counter for all ages, and we had a 10-year fight from 2003 to 2013. I was involved in the lawsuit. Also, I was one of the plaintiffs. We did a lot of civil disobedience around that. We threw the pill out into crowds. We gave it as a door prize at parties. We blocked the doors of the FDA. We did all kinds of things, and one of the important lessons that we got from that is go for what you really want. Don't back down and say, gosh, okay, maybe it's great that, you know, we can have it for just people who are over 17. All of those kinds of restrictions end up splitting your constituency. They are not what we need, and they're to organize, we need to go for something that will help the largest number of people, and not sort of back off. And that we were told to back off. We were told, oh, get it in emergency rooms for rape victims. Well, those of us who had been raped had never gone to an emergency room, so that wasn't going to help us. And frequently with the abortion struggle, we're told, oh, well, let's just go for less. It will be more likely to get it. But we're not going to be more likely to get it, because when you go for less, it helps fewer people. And then you have fewer people that are fighting for it and see it in their self-interest.
So you have a new book coming out, Without Apology, The Abortion Struggle Now. Could you tell us something about it and why it's so different from your other works?
Yeah, I mean, The Abortion Struggle Now is basically goes through in detail the history of how we won abortion rights and what the principles were that the radicals who won it used. And so I think it's going to be really good for us to look at that history and think about some of the victories that we've had recently. I also have a big section on the abortion struggle in Ireland, where they actually repealed their abortion law. I have a section on the women's health in women's hands, all of the women's self-help movement that had was going on in the 70s. I have a section on the struggle to get the New York law overturned. And the radical roots of what we did in those years have kind of been papered over, and now we're told, well, we have to lobby, we have to give money to have TV ads, and really the basic organizing is not being done. It's very much become something that experts and politicians and lawyers deal with rather than the grassroots. And so I think we need to get back to that, because that's how we were able to win in the first place.
And lastly, do you have any events coming up, or is there anything you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Yeah, I'll be at Broadway Books tonight at 7 in conversation with Lenny Zumas, who wrote the novel Red Clocks, which is also dealing with a lot of these issues. That's at 1714 Northeast Broadway Street.
Well, Jenny, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us today. That was our discussion with Jenny Brown, author and activist with the new book, Without Apology, The Abortion Struggle Now. I'm Leslie McLam.
And I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. Up next, it's Transpositions PDX. Do 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 do.
You are listening to KBOO KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.